Forgotten Harbor by Gordon Hillman. Whenever I hear the roar of the surf or feel fog on my face, I shudder in terror of the memory that those two wonders of nature bring back to my mind. It all happened because my friend Cranshaw had been called to Chicago on a case connected with the tax commission. A man there had demanded his taxes be lowered because a house he owned was haunted, and he could neither rent nor sell it. The tax commissioner, very justifiably at his wit's end, had called in Cranshaw, the greatest American authority on poltergeists. And so I had gone to Forgotten Harbor alone to enjoy a few peaceful autumn days, not knowing that fall in Forgotten Harbor means fog. But then, if I had known that, I should not have gone. And if I had not gone, Forgotten Harbor would have witnessed a tragedy even more horrible than the one which I saw. Out on the point, a bit away from the rambling town, stood an old hotel that one day soon would collapse into the sea. The summer visitors had all gone, and I was one of the few guests there. And even those few guests began leaving, some because of the fog, others because of the constant moan of foghorns as fog-bound ships sailed up the rocky coast. But most of them left because of the peculiar feel of the place. It was a curious feeling, hard to describe, yet I had felt it from the minute I arrived. That feeling was even stronger the day I quite innocently asked the proprietor of the hotel, "What's the name of the lighthouse out there on the island?" "Dead Man's Light," he said, and he turned oddly silent, as if he did not care to talk about it. "Curious name, Dead Man's Light," I said. "They just call it that around here," he told me uneasily. "Used to be known as Eastern Light. Still is on the government charts." "Why did they change the name?" I asked. His eyes flickered. "Oh, I don't know," he said. "It flashes white. Flashes every 10 seconds. He was not, I was quite convinced, telling the truth. He knew perfectly well why the light bore that grisly name. Now I was convinced more than ever that my senses had not betrayed me, that there was something peculiar about the white lighthouse on the shoal. I was still staring at Dead Man's Light when one of the waiters rushed up to me. "You're wanted on the phone, sir," he said. That was strange, for I knew no one in that part of the country. I picked up the receiver, and the operator's voice came over the wire in a high pitch of hysteria.
"Sheriff Fairbairn wants to see you at his office, sir, right away. Please, oh, please hurry, sir."
Why a sheriff should want to see me, I could not guess, but I hurried to the office as quickly as I could. The sheriff was nervously pacing up and down in front of a young woman who might have been pretty had her face not been white with terror. "You're a friend of Mr. Cranshaw's, aren't you?" the sheriff snapped before I had a chance to speak. I nodded in surprise. "And Mr. Cranshaw's a ghost hunter, isn't he?" "He is," I said, sitting down. "A sort of psychic detective. The only one in America, I believe." "Why?"
"We're at our wits' end," the sheriff said suddenly. "We want you to call Mr. Cranshaw here."
"But," I protested, "Mr. Cranshaw is a busy man." The sheriff pointed toward the window, where I could just see the white lighthouse through the fog.
"There's trouble out there," he said in a harsh whisper. "Trouble on Dead Man's Light. It was about a year ago," he said, "that the light got its name. That was when the first one went."
"Went?" said I. "Who went?"
"The lightkeeper," said the sheriff. went like a blown-out candle, went like a gust of wind. It was in a fog like this. Tom Thornton was keeper then, an old man who walked with a heavy cane. It was nighttime, and Tom's assistant, Atkinson, was over to the mainland. He left the old man alone with the light, alone in the brutal fog. He suddenly turned to the white-faced girl. "This young lady," he said, "works in the telephone exchange. She'll tell you what happened that night."
"At 11:45,
she said,
"a call came in, a call from the lighthouse. I answered it, and at first there wasn't any sound at all, except a tapping that might have been a man with a heavy cane. Then the line seemed to go dead, only it didn't. There was a scream, just one single scream, not another thing, though we held the line open."
She looked out at the light, then buried her face in her hands. The sheriff went on in a voice that seemed hollow and dead. "The telephone company called me," he said. "I listened in on the line. At 12:30, Atkinson began to yell through the phone. He'd just got back, and Tom wasn't there at all. Atkinson found the phone off the hook," he said, "and he wanted me to come right out there. When I got there, an hour later, there was no man, alive or dead, in that lighthouse. Atkinson had gone too. Gone like Tom."
"Disappeared?"
I asked. "Vanished into thin air. There's not a trace of either of them been seen since. No bodies found. Nothing." I shook my head. "That's a murder, perhaps," I said. "Or a double murder. But it's hardly in Mr. Cranshaw's line." "That isn't all," the sheriff said. Then he turned to the telephone operator. "Tell him what's happened at 11:45 every night this week." The girl clenched her handkerchief.
"The phone from the lighthouse rings,"
she said shakily,
"and we answer it. And there's nothing on the line but slow taps, like a lame man walking with a cane. There were lots of taps at first. Last night, there were only 3. And then comes that horrible, ghastly..."
She could not finish. "Scream," the sheriff said huskily. "A scream out of nowhere."
"But there must be men out at the lighthouse now," I said.
The sheriff nodded. "We've checked up. Neither one of them has touched the phone at night."
"That's odd," I said.
"The whole town's in terror, sir," he said. "That lighthouse is haunted." I still wasn't sure as I left the sheriff's office. Should I call Cranshaw in on what might be a wild goose chase, a practical joke, or a mere case of nerves on the part of a telephone operator? Yet, despite my doubts, I felt that strange atmosphere that hung over Forgotten Harbor like its endless fog. It seemed as if the whole town was waiting for something to happen. Something unnatural. Something ghastly. I had to think this over. I went into a restaurant, sat down in a booth, and ordered coffee. I could hear a young man's excited voice coming from the booth next to mine. "I tell you," he was shouting, "I won't stay there much longer. They'll either relieve me or..." The plump proprietress of the restaurant came to give me my coffee and jerked her thumb toward the owner of the voice.
"Don't mind him," she said. "He's crazy."
"Who is he?"
"Him,"
she said.
"He's one of the keepers out at the light."
"No, no, Matt," I could hear another and deeper voice say. "You'd better straighten up. There's nothing in what you say. Such things don't happen hereabouts. You'd better get back to Dead Man's Light.
That's right, said Matt, louder than before. That's what it is. Dead Man's Light. The light where dead men don't die. They don't die, I tell you. They don't.
Then I saw the owner of the voice. A very lean and bronzed young man with a look of terror in his eyes. A grizzled fisherman was guiding him out of the booth, saying,
There's naught in that, Matt. You'll be all right when you're back in your lighthouse.
Back there! Screamed the boy. Back where that thing will get me. That thing that comes out of the fog.
The outside door was slammed, and that was all I heard. But it was enough. I practically ran to the railroad station. Drop tax matter, I wired Cranshaw. Hurry here. Most mysterious case of your career. Haste imperative. I knew the mere hint of eerie doings would bring Cranshaw like a shot. And it did. 2 days later, he stepped off the train at Forgotten Harbor. He said at once. Uneasy feeling about this place. Something's going to happen here. Something already has, I told him. And as we sat in my hotel room, I recounted the whole story. Cranshaw listened to the end, then took a pair of field glasses from his bag and focused them on the lighthouse and the little island upon which it stood. For perhaps 5 minutes he surveyed the sandy ground, and then gave a sudden start. Here, he said, look through these. Look at the south end of the island, just beneath the light. Do you see anything? For a moment, I could see nothing. Then I did see something, and I nearly dropped the glasses. At the very foot of the lighthouse were two odd-shaped mounds, narrow and about 6 feet long, I should say. In the sharp light of sunset, they seemed to grow and grow. Their outlines became firmer. They suggested... Graves, whispered Cranshaw. Two graves... Watch them. Don't take your eyes off them. Though my hands shook, I clung to the glasses. I had looked at the island before, through a telescope. There had been no mounds then, no graves. And these mounds I saw were rapidly losing form, losing shape, disappearing into a flat level of sand, disappearing into nothingness, as two men had disappeared a year ago tonight. Had it been the sharp light of sunset that brought out these two graves? Was it a mirage? Suddenly they were completely gone, and as I turned to Cranshaw, whose face was as puzzled as mine, a bell began to clang in the town. It was no ordinary bell. There was something about its ring that brought chills to my spine, and it rang through the fog, rang through the gathering darkness, rang as if each new stroke was a signal of doom. My God, said I. What's that? The bell rang so loudly I could hardly hear a knock on our door. The door opened and the sheriff burst in. Mr. Cranshaw, he called. For God's sake, do something. Of us all, Cranshaw was the only one who remained calm. Are you Sheriff Fairbairn? He asked. The sheriff nodded. Good. Tell me now, are there two graves on the south end of Dead Man's Island? Two graves just in the shadow of the light?
No, said the sheriff. No, sir. Some folks say they've seen 'em, but I've looked. There are no graves.
The alarm bell still rang.
What's that? Asked Cranshaw. It's the huge bell on the life-saving station, said the sheriff. It hasn't rung since the Northern Prince went down 32 years ago.
Well, why is it ringing now? I asked. Is there another wreck?
No, sir, quavered the sheriff. Not yet. Nobody's ringing that bell, sir. Nobody human. I've got one of my deputies standing guard beside the bell rope. That bell rope doesn't move, but the bell's ringing. Ringing like mad.
Crownshaw was already putting on his overcoat, slipping a notebook into one pocket, a revolver in the other. "This noon," the sheriff went on, "two fishermen came to me, scared to death. They came in past the lighthouse last night, and they say they saw a lantern in the fog." "Good God!" I shouted, for my nerves were fast getting the better of me. "A lantern's nothing to worry about," the sheriff shouted back. "But this one is. It moved about knee-high, slow, as if a man was walking with it. A man who didn't walk very well. But it wasn't on the island. It was on the water." "In a boat, then?" asked Cranshaw. The sheriff shuddered. "There wasn't any boat. There wasn't anything out there but the lantern, and the fishermen nearly ran it down." Cranshaw turned on the sheriff. "Now, Mr. Fairbairn," he said, "there's no use disguising the fact that this is a serious situation, and an uncommonly nasty one. I want you to keep your head and answer two or three questions, and answer them quickly."
"Okay," said the sheriff.
"First question," snapped Cranshaw. "Was there another of those queer telephone calls from the light last night?"
"There was."
"How many times did the dead man's cane tap?"
"Only once. It's been tapping one less time every night now."
Cranshaw frowned. "The time's short," he said. "I should have been called here before. There's a boat due here tonight, isn't there?"
"Yes," said the sheriff. "Queensland Castle. Big passenger ship, and she'll be due about midnight."
I knew it, said Cranshaw, half under his breath. Then he turned to the sheriff again. "Mr. Fairbairn, something strange, something horrible is going to happen on Dead Man's Light tonight. I may be able to prevent it, and I may not. What I want to know is, will you implicitly follow my orders for the next 24 hours? The sheriff sighed with relief.
"Gladly, Mr. Cranshaw. This business is driving me out of my head, and I'm not the only one. Since that bell's begun to ring, the whole town's in terror. Give me your orders. I'll follow them."
"First," said Cranshaw, "I want you to make me a deputy sheriff. Second, I want authority to spend tonight at Dead Man's Light."
"You're practically sworn in," said the sheriff. "But the lighthouse is government property."
Cranshaw spoke slowly, measuring his words. "It may mean disaster if I don't get there tonight." The sheriff thought for a moment, then said,
"As peace officer of Folsom County, I authorize you to stay at the lighthouse as long as you wish. What else, sir?"
Cranshaw was already at the door. "You stay in town," he snapped. "Put one of your men on the telephone switchboard in the exchange. Have him answer anything from the lighthouse. Don't let him leave his post. Station yourself at the life-saving station. Run the surf boat out on the beach. Have every powerboat in the harbor ready to move on an instant's notice. Commandeer all available seamen to man them." The sheriff seemed about to say something, but Cranshaw held up his hand for silence. In the distance, the big bell was still booming. "The last time that rang, Sheriff, the Northern Prince went down. It went down on Dead Man's Shoal, didn't it?" The sheriff nodded, his face white as chalk. Cranshaw spoke to him again as we went down the steps of the hotel. "Remember," he said, "at the slightest sign or hint of anything out of the ordinary at Dead Man's Light, get every available craft started for the shoal." He stopped and then added, "Tell your deputies to load their guns." I was completely confused. If Dead Man's Light was haunted, what good would guns do against a ghost? If it wasn't... The sheriff suddenly shouted to a man across the street, a man who was built like a gorilla, whose face even resembled one.
"That's Roger Wilson, the lightkeeper," he hastily said to Cranshaw as Wilson walked over. "Wilson, I want you to take these two gentlemen out to the light. They're spending the night there." The lightkeeper's voice was a deep boom.
"Can't. Against the rules. It's government property."
"And?"
said the sheriff. You ought to take them out now in your boat. If you don't, I'll arrest you for obstructing justice. Wilson only nodded his head and led us to the waterfront. In silence, we climbed into his small motorboat. In silence, the sheriff watched us leave. The fog came down again, like a pall. Through it, we could dimly see that 10-second flash of white that meant Dead Man's Light was ahead.
"There have been some queer doings on your light lately," said Cranshaw smoothly.
The lightkeeper shrugged his shoulders.
"Some folks say so. Haven't seen them myself. You won't see anything neither."
"Nor hear anything?" asked Cranshaw sharply.
"Nothing to hear,"
growled the lightkeeper.
"You've no right to be out there anyway. I'll report the sheriff to Washington."
Cranshaw leaned forward, his voice cutting like a knife.
"I wouldn't," he said softly. "Washington's still interested in what became of its two lightkeepers a year ago tonight.
And so am I." Wilson knelt down to do something to the engine. He growled.
"Secret Service men, huh?"
Cranshaw did not answer. I could quite see why. It would do no harm for the lightkeeper to believe we were Department of Justice men. Might do some good.
"Well,"
shrugged Wilson as we touched the tip of Dead Man's Island,
"you'll find nothing out here."
I wasn't so sure of that. Out here, on the bare little island that boasted only one house and the towering lighthouse itself, the atmosphere was stranger than it had been in town. I shuddered at the thought of what was going to happen. As we stood on shore, the big light winked at us. In it, I could see a man standing against the little iron railing at the top. "That's Matt," I whispered. "The assistant keeper, the one I told you about." Cranshaw nodded, and somewhere a clock struck 7. 5 hours till midnight, snapped Cranshaw. "That doesn't give us much time to find anything. Come on." We went across the strip of sand that separated the house from the light. It was already quite dark, and Cranshaw's flashlight threw a golden ring ahead of us. It shifted once to the very base of the lighthouse. The sand was hard packed there, smooth and flat. There was no sign of a mound or a grave.
"I saw them," I said, "with my own eyes. So did you."
"No matter," said Cranshaw impatiently. "The sheriff says they're only seen at sunset. Hurry." We entered the lighthouse and pounded up innumerable rounds of iron stairs. At last we came to the top, where the great lamp wheeled and sent out its rays to pierce the fog. The fog was thicker than ever. Through it you could hear the seabirds' cries, and occasionally the faint, far-off whistle of a ship. "Keep your eyes away from the lamp," Cranshaw said sharply, "or it'll blind you." At the top, Matt met us. Cranshaw went straight toward him. "Tell me what you know," he snapped. "All you know about Dead Man's Light. Sheriff's orders."
"Oh, government men," said Matt shakily. "Won't do any good. You'll never find anything. Never."
"Now calm down," said Cranshaw, "and tell us what you're afraid of." Matt leaned toward us and whispered as the great light wheeled and swung, wheeled and flashed. "It's this thing," he whispered. "A horrible thing comes out of the fog. Dead man's face. A dead man's footsteps. I don't mind the ghost lantern, nor the noises, but that face, mister. It's not human. It's not alive. It looks as if..." I heard a shuffling noise, and there was Wilson standing on the stairway, listening. Suddenly he shouted,
"Matt, I'm coming up to take over."
Cranshaw nodded to me, and we went down. As we passed Wilson, he hissed,
"Don't mind Matt. He's a little crazy."
To my surprise, Cranshaw emphatically agreed with him.
Absolutely, he said.
I followed Cranshaw across the fog-bound sands to the house. He opened the door and went in. Downstairs there was a long living room that smelled of pipe smoke. There were three windows, all facing east. Upstairs there were two bedrooms.
No one's up there, reported Cranshaw after a search.
The telephone was in the corner of the living room. He motioned me toward it. Take the receiver off the hook, he commanded, and tell the sheriff's deputy that nothing's happened yet but to stand by for trouble. I picked up the receiver. Above the telephone was a clock, its hands racing toward the hour of 8.
Hello? Hello?
I shouted into the phone. There wasn't a sound. The line was dead. Then I could hear footsteps. A lame man's footsteps. The tap, tap of a man with a heavy cane. The noise was coming through the telephone. One tap, two taps, three, four. Then silence again. I waited, my ears tense, my nerves jangling, for an unearthly scream. The scream of a man in agony. The scream of a man near death. But no scream came. Above me, the clock had begun to strike 8.
Cranshaw! Cranshaw! I shouted. There were 4 taps. 4 distinct taps.
My friend nodded as his hand closed on the revolver in his pocket.
Hang up, he said quietly.
Now try the mainland again. There are just 4 hours left before something happens here. Tell the sheriff's deputy to have all boats ready to leave the harbor at precisely 12:01. This time the line was clear, and I delivered my message.
Well, I said to Cranshaw, what now?
Wait, he said. I must have dozed off, but when I opened my eyes, it was 11:30. And a salt wind was blowing through the door. Matt stood there, the mist in little beads on his cap and face.
Wilson sent me back here, he mumbled. It's almost time.
Time for what? Snapped Cranshaw.
You'll see. You'll see,
said Matt, as he sank down in a chair, his eyes riveted on those 3 east windows. I looked out the windows too. But all I could see was fog. All I could hear was the ship's whistle. It seemed almost on top of us now. Cranshaw slipped the revolver back into his pocket. I'll take a turnabout outside, he said. Stay by that phone. He opened the door and stepped into the fog. Seconds after Cranshaw left, the lights went out. Went out as if some hand had swiftly cut them off. Yet Matt was still sitting in his chair, 20 feet from the switch. As the lights went out, a great glow from the lighthouse flashed about us. And there, in the window, coming out of the fog, was a face. No body. No arms. Just a face, drifting on the fog. The face of no living man. No human face. It was black. Cinder black. As if it had been burned. Its eyelids were closed over what should have been eyes. Slowly, as it pressed against the pane, those eyelids opened. There were no eyes. It was horrible.
Matt suddenly screamed. It's pecking at the glass. It's coming in. The thing's coming in.
Dead man's light flashed no longer. It was pitch dark. The face had gone from the now mysteriously opened window. I heard a sharp cry in the dark. The cry of a man being choked. It was Matt's cry. Though every fiber in me protested, I hurled myself toward Matt, felt something cold flash by my face, something that froze every drop of blood in my body. Suddenly, I felt clammy hands on my throat. I fought frantically. But there was nothing. No one there. I was being choked to death by nothing. In a daze, I dragged myself from that clutch, dragged myself across the floor, found the switch, and the lights went on. Matt lay on the floor, unconscious. There were ghastly red marks on his throat. The marks of clawing fingers. There was no one else in the room. But in the rug, there was a deep, round imprint, such as a steel shaft of a heavy cane might make. The window was still wide open. Its lock had been broken. "Cranshaw!" I shouted. "Cranshaw!" The door opened, and he ran in. Without a word, he lifted Matt's head, looked at the scarlet marks on his throat. "There must be some brandy here," he shouted. He found some in a cabinet and poured a little down Matt's throat. I looked up at the clock. It was 12:02, and that fog whistle was deafening. The ship must practically be on the island, I thought. It was still dark outside. Matt, who had regained consciousness, tried to stand up. "The light! The light's gone out!" he cried. Cranshaw and I raced for the door. Above us rose the shaft of the lighthouse. But where there should have been the great flow of the lamp, there was only darkness. Darkness all around, except to the east. There, barely visible, were the lights of a liner making for the harbour. The ship's whistle blew, frantically, in short, sharp blasts, as though calling in panic for the light to flash again. "Quick!" shouted Cranshaw. "The telephone!" He was gone in an instant, his revolver in hand, racing toward Dead Man's Light with Matt. I ran in and reached for the telephone. Above it, the clock said 12:01. I tore down the receiver and jangled the hook. The steamer's whistle blared again. Closer. Closer.
"Hello,"
said a voice at the end of the phone.
"Hello?"
"The light's out," I shouted. "The Queensland Castle is coming in. She's nearly on the rocks. Get that life-saving crew started." The line clicked shut, and as I looked out the door, I could see the light of the steamer drifting toward disaster. Then another light flashed. It was a lantern where no lantern should have been. A lantern in the fog. A lantern on the very surface of the sea. It seemed to move slowly, jerkily, but it still moved faster than Cranshaw and Matt. It moved toward the lighthouse. Entered it. I saw it through the lighthouse windows, going up, up, as if mounting the stairs. Then, in a sudden burst of glory, Dead Man's Light shone full on my face. The great lamp was blazing, swinging, flashing. The steamer's siren screamed. I could hear a chorus of shouted commands. "Hard over, full speed astern." There was an instant when her bow shot out of the fog, when it seemed almost to crash down upon me. Then it slowed, stopped, and backed away as the whistle roared and a jangle of bells came from the engine room. In the dark town beyond, a rocket went up, and I could hear the sirens of boats racing down the bay as the big alarm bell on the life-saving station boomed and boomed again. I ran out of the house. To the east, the steamer's lights were slowly swinging away as she took her course up the bay. Above me, Dead Man's Light flashed, and flashed again. And then Cranshaw was beside me, beads of perspiration on his face. "The lightkeeper is dead," he said huskily. "Up there in the light, dead, without a mark on him. I wouldn't go to look if I were you." Even before he died, he was being blinded. Blinded because, as he was dying, his face was held close to the light itself. "Held?" I gasped. "Held," said Cranshaw. "You saw the lantern coming out of the sea, I suppose. Well, that's that. It's all over now." It was all over, save for explanations to the sheriff, who came running up the sand. "My God, Mr. Cranshaw," said the sheriff. after he had heard the tale of that night of terror.
A dead man in the lighthouse, another man nearly choked to death, the Queensland castle nearly wrecked. What do you make of it all?
Cranshaw placidly lit his pipe. As far as he was concerned, the case was closed.
A year ago tonight, he said, two men disappeared out here.
They didn't disappear. They were murdered. There's an old passageway under the lighthouse. It's sealed up now. Unseal it, and you'll find their bodies. Under the sands. Under the spot where we saw the two graves at sunset.
But who murdered them?
Gasped the sheriff. Cranshaw almost smiled.
That's elementary.
Roger Wilson murdered them. He wanted this lighthouse job when old Tom Thornton got it. Wilson never forgave him. He waited a year or so for old Tom to die. But old Tom didn't die. So Wilson came here 1 year ago tonight, killed the old man, and hid his body.
Then he killed young Atkinson.
Then he put the bodies in the secret passage and went away again. Wilson was next in line for the lighthouse job. He took it, never realizing that old Tom would come back to haunt the light.
My God, it's incredible, the sheriff said.
Even when he found out Dead Man's Light was haunted, said Cranshaw. Wilson wouldn't quit. He wouldn't be beaten by a dead man. But he did go mad. He'd already killed two men. He wanted to kill more. He was a homicidal maniac. That's why he tried to wreck the Queensland Castle. He would have, too, despite all our efforts. If it hadn't been for... The sheriff looked fearfully behind him.
If it hadn't been for a dead man, he breathed.
Precisely, said Cranshaw, as if that were a most commonplace matter. I don't know how you're going to write that down in the records, sheriff.
For once, I thought I had found a flaw in Cranshaw's explanation. But why? I asked, if old Tom, the dead man, wanted revenge on Wilson, well, why did the thing try to strangle Matt?
I don't exactly know, said Cranshaw, but I suspect that before Wilson murdered old Tom, he did a fiendish thing. He held the old man's face toward the light, till his eyes were burned out, till he was blinded. The sheriff dropped his pipe.
You mean, he gasped, the dead man couldn't see?
Perhaps, said Cranshaw, but that we'll never know. Today the folk of Forgotten Harbour claim that Dead Man's Light is haunted still. They say, too, that a ghost lantern often flickers through the fog. But it does not matter now. After the two bodies were found in the old passageway, the government abandoned Dead Man's Light. The new lighthouse is on the opposite shoal. Today's story was Forgotten Harbour by Gordon Hillman. It was read by Jasper Lestrange. As always, I hope you enjoyed it. And until next time, sweet dreams.